हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay. So continuing with Bhaktivinoda Thakur's, I think there's a third chapter like that of the Jayavidhama. For the souls bound by Maya, the activities of Ragatmika are far away and the activities of Raganuga are not accepted. It is only by the mercy of a devotee of the Lord that the activities of Raganuga may rise within a conditioned soul's heart. The activities of Raganuga are rare and difficult to attain. The residents of the material world have been cheated of them. However, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is all-knowing and full of mercy. He sees that the souls imprisoned by Maya have been cheated by their spiritual activities. How will these souls attain auspiciousness? By what means will the souls bewildered by Maya remember Lord Krishna? The answer is, by associating with saintly devotees, the soul is able to understand that he is in reality a servant of Lord Krishna. The rules of ordinary piety do not enjoin that one associate with saintly devotees. How then does one associate with devotees? What makes one desire to associate with the devotees? The association of the devotees does not generally happen when one follows the path of rules and regulations, vidhi marg. That is not the way one comes to associate with devotees. It is from the merciful glance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that the scriptures are created, born from the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The sun of the scriptures rises in the sky of the devotee's heart. In this way, the rules of piety are manifested. In the beginning is the Veda. One part of the Veda teaches fruit of work, another part transcendental knowledge, and another part loving devotional service. The individual soul is bewildered by Maya, are situated in different states of existence. Some are very bewildered, some are a little enlightened, and some are very enlightened. In this way, the conditioned souls have different kinds of intelligence. The Veda teaches all these classes of souls. Although one may consider that the souls have an infinite variety of natures, still they are grouped into three broad categories. 1. Those qualified to perform fruit of work, karma. Those eligible for transcendental knowledge, jnana. And those eligible to engage in loving devotional service, prema, to the Supreme Lord. The Veda is thus describes these three categories of eligibility. The Veda's description of what should and should not be done by these three classes of living entities constitute Vaidhi Dharma, the rules of religion. When one actively performs pious deeds, that is called Vaidhi Pravritti. They who do not follow the rules of Vaidhi commit sinful acts. Therefore, living entities should always avoid actions that violate these rules and regulations. They who are outside the jurisdiction of the Vedas are called by the name Malecha and other names also. The conclusion then is that three classes of living entities are qualified to follow the Veda. For their benefit, the great sages have written many books to supplement the hymns of the Veda. Manu and 20 other sages thus wrote the Dharma Shastras to benefit the persons eligible to perform pious work, karma. Different philosophers wrote books of logic and philosophy to benefit the persons eligible for philosophical speculation, jnana. The great devotees wrote the Puranas and pure tantras to teach the persons eligible to engage in devotional service, bhakti, and to guide their actions. This is the nature of the Vedic literatures. The philosophy of the Mimamsakas is not seen anywhere in the original scriptures. Every point the Mimamsakas claims shows the superiority of their idea is easily thrown into a dark hole of counter-arguments and doubts. In all the scriptures, the Uttaramimamsa, Vedanta philosophy, is most clearly shown in Bhagavad Gita. The teaching of karma that ignores jnana in an atheist kind of karma, and teaching should be rejected. In the same way, the teaching of karma and jnana that ignores bhakti is atheistic karma and jnana. There are only three kinds of yoga: karma yoga, jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga. That is the Vaishnava description, the Vedas teachings. I think this is the
Vaishnava Das.
Yeah, no. Oh, Vaishnava Das is explaining. Yeah, that's right. Vaishnava Das is explaining. We had this some man. I think he came from Shantipur, born in a very high Brahmin family, and he was engaged in all kinds of activities, you know, karma and this and that. And he was, I think, quite renowned in his circle. Then he was very good at music, like that. And then somehow or another, he started to get into devotional service. And he, because of his singing in that, then people were very much appreciated what he was doing. And so he became quite, you know, in his own right, in his own place, quite a popular, seen as a very senior person. So he's now come to Navadvip, and then, though he's a devotee, he's very much caught up in this idea that the third chapter. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. He's caught up very much in the idea that anybody can be a devotee, but only those who are Brahmins, from Brahmin families, they can be acharyas, they can give initiation, and that kind of thing. So it's kind of like, it's got that Hindu thing, that piety thing mixed. And so then he's come and he wants to ask some questions to the Babaji Maharaj, because he's heard he's very advanced. And then since Vaishnava Das is there, and he's now kind of like given up all his attachments to his, you know, previous kind of lifestyle and all that, then he's taken up fully the Vaishnava activities. So he's now dressed, you know, in the Babaji Vesh and that. And so he's been asked to explain to him, since he is from, you know, also a high Brahmin family, took sannyas, studied all the scriptures, so that way then this other person would naturally respect anything he would say like that. Though I don't think it's been explained to that other person that his position, but it's just natural, you know, as you use it means the, since he's from that position, he engages that position to correct the same problem, you know, the same problem he had. And if he helps others overcome that, then that secures his correction. So here he's explaining to him, he's going through, because he's brought up about Dharma Shastras and all that. That seems to be the other person's like expertise or his field. So he's trying to point out here what is the real thing of the Vedas and the real understanding of the different paths of the Vedas, the karma, jnana, and upasana. So then he's pointed out here that karma that's separated from God consciousness is atheistic, so it's not real. Jnana also that's separated is atheistic. And then the upasana means worship of the Supreme Lord. So then here he's given that the Dharma Shastras are, you know, especially for those who are performing fruitive work. Though everyone follows those rules, because if you don't, the only thing left is sinful activities. The Dharma Shastras cover everything. So if they're not followed, then that means one is engaged in sinful activities. So therefore, that's the natural social standard for, you know, all peoples. But at the same time, as being the Vaidhi mark, here he seems to be also pulling in the Vaidhi, meaning also the Varnashram. Because we see in the nine processes of devotional service, then dasyam basically means following a varnashram, like that. That's the, because it's rules and regulations. So if we take from the Vedic, civilization, then we see from the Shruti comes the Smriti, and then of the Smriti, then the ultimate or conclusion then is the Bhagavatam. So it'll be seen that it's based on the Veda. Though we also know from on the transcendental platform that the Bhagavat
platform is there first, then comes the Vaidhi platform. It means Vrindavan is there first, then the mix in Dwarka, then you get Vaikuntha. And so then when it comes into the material world, then Vaikuntha comes in first, then it manifests down. But, so that's important for understanding where one is going, but for freeing oneself from conditioning, then the Vaidhi is important. So then, but the difficulty is the Varnashram does not describe the importance of associating with saintly persons. It tells what you should do, and it tells, you know, what others should do, what is your relationship with them, how to work out various problems, what to do if something goes wrong, how the administrator should manage the country, these things. Though at the same time, is because one is supposed to, like the householder should entertain Brahmins, give in charity, must do sacrifice, this and that. But it doesn't directly say that one should get the association of saintly persons. So then the difficulty comes, and it doesn't directly say, I mean, it does say that the purpose is to connect oneself to the Lord. So the opening of Manusamhita, the invocation, does establish that it's actually meant for devotional service. It's for knowing the Supreme Lord, the whole Varnashram system. That's its only purpose. But probably, it appears that probably, you know, greater than 99.99% miss that point. You know, you'd have to add quite a few more 99s on behind the decimal point. Is that they miss that point completely, though that's in the invocation. It opens like that. Is that it and it, so the difficulty then comes is, means one is supposed to, by performing yajnas and giving in charity and feeding Brahmins, then the whole idea is a real Brahmin will be a Vaishnava, so then you'll get that association. And that association then will elevate one. But at the same time, it might not happen. Like we see Maharaj Prachina Barhishat. Now, he's not a young man. He's not a new king. He's a mature king. He's been there. His sons are grown. They're in the forest doing penance. You know, like this. So he's quite well established. So this is a difficulty then, is that he had gone through his whole life, all his training in the Gurukul, all his training, you know, under the head priest, then all his activities as the king, and all his performance of yajna and sacrifice and all the things that he's done, great pious activities, huge amount of pious activities. Not one of them told him about devotional service. So then this becomes a difficulty. Is though technically it should work, but there's many who, they themselves are not that advanced, so they don't speak much. Or somehow or another, they just miss out on the point. Because the rules and regulations, basically it's centered about, though it means, of course, Dharma means what is the nature, so you have to know what is your nature and what you should do. But the tendency on material piety is that one is actually quite self-centered, though it's a pure self-centeredness. You know, you're understanding that the nature of the gross body, the subtle body, and understand the eternality of the soul, like that, because the karma is talked about, and transmigration of the soul. To actually follow Varnashram, you have to believe in karma. You have to, otherwise you can't really have the faith in it. Or at least not as much as one should, like that. So the weakness is that it doesn't really push that point. And also we see is that the neophyte has a tendency to not be so much inclined towards association of devotees. It means if they like someone, they like them, they'd be with them. But by nature, they don't see. So we see it's a very unique thing that Prabhupada's done. Because the association of devotees is generally a symptom of the higher advancement. So you see, Srila Prabhupada's created a society where there's so much association is very much sought after. So even though he's established the rules and regulations, at the same time he's actually established basically a Raganuga mission. You know? Though so many claim it's Vaidhi, and this one says this, that one says that, so many people say so many things within the society, outside the society, But actually, if you study it, and you see like what is being explained here, is he is wanting to establish Varnashram. So he's only explained, you know, three paths, the karma, the jnana, and the yoga. And in the bhakti, then we see is that within that, then there's that which leans more on the vaidhi, and then there's more that leans on the raganuga. So if he has yet to, he was in the process of establishing Varnashram, if it is accepted that it's devotional service, what conclusion does that leave? It has to be based on the principles of raganuga. Though, it's raganuga for those who are neophytes, so therefore there's some rules. But the basic principle is how it is that spontaneous desire to serve and associate and all that. So it's a very unique, amazing thing that has been created by Srila Prabhupada. Something very, very unique like that. So it's very much ununderstandable by anyone. It means those who are followers of the Vedic culture can't figure out if we're Hindus or not. You know, those who are other branches of the Gaudiya, mission of Lord Chaitanya, they also can't figure out. They'll say we're Vaidhi, but at the same time, then they'll complain we don't follow the rules. So it's a very unique position that Prabhupada's done, because he's given the essence, and the essence is the bhakti. So he's pointing out that it's actually very rare to get this, the raganuga aspect, because the raganuga then because he's made the point is that by the pious activities don't really stress the point of association. So how will they get Krishna? Because you can only get Krishna by the association of devotees. Right? They don't know much about it from the Vaidhi. So then how to do? I think here mainly Vaidhi is meaning the Varnashram at this point. At the same time as it does overlap into the devotional process also, the Vidhi Marg. But it's any questions on this or go on?
I just had an interesting thought as you were speaking. It's a comment, but if you can further comment. Sometimes people ask, you know, if Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and chanting is the way to achieve Him and it's so clear, any ISKCON devotee will speak it openly on the street, why isn't it so clear in the Vedas? And then my thought is that the Vedas are given by Krishna and Krishna won't give bhakti. It's only given by a devotee. And yeah, so he's giving the Veda, but he can't give bhakti because he doesn't want to interfere with the free will of the jiva.
Yeah.
And so it's for a devotee to take the Veda and say, this is the Veda, but it means this. It means surrender to Krishna, chant his holy name, associate with devotees. That is the meaning of the Veda. And it may be confusing for people, but Krishna is bound by respecting the free will of the jiva not to give a clear indication like that.
I think there's a place, I don't know if it's here or if it's in Navadvip Dham Mahatmya or something, where there's a discussion. I think Krishna is telling Maya, or Krishna is telling someone to tell Maya that she can remove the covering of all these verses within the scriptures that talk about the Sankirtan mission, because the time for Lord Chaitanya has come, so now she can remove that, because though they're there, they can't see it. Like Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, then when Lord Chaitanya came and he saw him and spoke to him, he starts quoting verses that he's known, but he couldn't understand them. You know, all these things about the Lord will come like this and this and that. He was quoting so many. He knows the verses, but they're bewildering to him. And he was the greatest of scholars at the time. And so he couldn't understand it, means no one understood it. But then when he saw Lord Chaitanya, then it all became revealed and he understood exactly what it meant. So it's like here he says,
There are only three kinds of yoga: karma yoga, jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga. That is the Vaishnava description of the Veda's teaching.
So that means the whole thing. We put it into these three categories. And also, you know, as yoga, in that, because you can have karma just on its own and be bewildered. You can have jnana that's owned and be bewildered like that. But the real yoga is then this. So then karma, jnana, and yoga, and bhakti yoga, these become part of the same path. So the neophyte will emphasize more the karma, the madhyam more the jnana, and the uttam the bhakti. So how do you say, in that, though it's all bhakti, like that.
Raj?
Yeah.
We understand that the varnashram dharma is centered around dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. And generally, it says that after kama, when you get frustrated, then people look for moksha. So, doesn't the varnashrama scheme, I mean, not connected to pure, if it's not connected to Krishna consciousness, do the desires of the living entity decrease, or is it just frustration that leads
it? It's frustration. Decreasing means that it flips to the opposite. You want something so much, and then when an obstacle suddenly comes up, immediately you don't want it. Like that. You can see something you're very... See, if you're not so attached, then you just move towards it. You know, or if you have a very long vision, then you know there's obstacles and you can move around them. But when you find that there's something that's very like acute in the heart, you're very attached to it, and you endeavor for it, as soon as there's an obstacle come up, one can get very frustrated and just flip the opposite way. You know, you see that very much, like you've decided, okay, we're going to go... You know, we're going to go someplace and get a particular thing to eat, and you very much want that. And then when you get there and there's some obstacle to get it, then it's not that, okay, we can't go that, let's go here. It's not, no, we're not eating. You know, I won't eat. You know, it's just you get that. You want to eat so much, but because you couldn't get what you wanted, then we're not going to eat. So that's the impersonal path. Is that you couldn't get what they were looking for. It means the living entity has to have rasa. So they couldn't get it in Dharma, Artha, Kama. So then they figure that it has to be something else. So just by logic, then if you don't know anything else other than this world, then naturally you consider that there must be something that's just the opposite of this. Like that. And so then because of that, then you end up with the problems of the impersonal. So it's actually more difficult for an impersonalist to become a devotee than it is for a karmi. Because the karmi acknowledges they're looking for taste, they're looking for, you know, like this. Well, the impersonalist, even though he also is looking for a taste, he won't accept it in the way of form and senses and interaction or anything like this. He's become frustrated in this. So it's actually a more difficult position to become elevated from, like that. If someone does, then there's a great advantage, like this sannyasi here, is that they're already detached from the material world, so there's no material endeavor. So if they can get beyond the impersonal state to understand that the spiritual world, there is activity, it's full of rasa and interaction, but at the same time, it's different from what's here. Therefore, being detached from what's here is good, but being able to take advantage and direction from what's here is also necessary. Then it's very nice. Then it can be an advantage. But generally speaking, they're so polluted by this impersonal concept, it's very difficult for them. Like that. Same time, just someone so much absorbed in karma, it's also because then they feel the piety and, you know, they don't want to lose and they'll, you know, they just want to be good. So then they can't give up the things here. So they're both quite serious traps. That's why we're only interested in varnashram in connection with devotional service, as daiva varnashram. Otherwise, for us, there's no meaning to it. It means it's nice, it's pious. It means if a person is going to be a non-devotee, better they follow the Vedic culture, because it's more enlightening. There's more of a chance like that. But at the same time, if someone's not, then we don't. You know, it's okay because they're going to get frustrated probably quicker. So the varnashramite will become frustrated over a longer period of time because things go generally pretty well. And those who are not following the varnashram, they'll become frustrated quicker because by non-Vedic life, frustrations come very fast. You know, sin brings frustration very quickly. But the problem is because of the lack of following any rules, then the tendency is, then they can't take up the rules of the devotional service, the culture. They can acknowledge the philosophy, but the culture is very hard because they've been living without a culture. And then the people who follow the culture, then they can follow the culture, but their difficulty is understanding the philosophy. You know, though their lifestyle is pious. And then the jnanis, they can understand the philosophy, but they can't understand how you could use the seemingly material karma for transcendental purposes. Because for them, karma brings, pious activities brings material pious results. So they don't understand pious activities done for Krishna gives a transcendental result. So each one of them has a problem. Therefore the solution is only by the association of the devotees, then one can cross over this, because they'll show you what's the actual meaning of karma, the actual meaning of jnana, and what is the path of bhakti. Does that make some sense?
So according to the Varnashram Dharma, those who follow the Dharma, Artha, Kama, and they tend for impersonal liberation, they head for that?
It's the natural thing.
Okay.
It's the natural thing, but it's not what it's supposed to be for. It's supposed to be one is following the Vedic system for worship of the Supreme Lord. So the Dharma, Artha, and Kama is, and then moksha means that they go towards the Lord. But because they have material desire, they engage that desire. But it's a slow path. It's slow. We even see in those who follow this path using Varnashram very prominently as the devotional service, is they go up through the whole, they have to go through the whole basically hierarchy of the universe, get up to Lord Brahma, to have to become Indra, to have to become all these different sages and Prajapatis and then Brahma. Then from that, then they can cross over. Kind of like you see Gopakumar, that's probably why it's written like that. Sanatan Goswami's thing in Gopakumar, he goes through all these different planes of existence. And then he shows how each one of them on its own is inferior. It means it's not, how do you say? It's weaknesses if it's not connected to the Lord. The same times we see in most of those positions, the Lord is present. Right? The king is worshipping the deity. Indra has Vamanadev, you know, as his association. Then the sages, they perform the yajnas, and the Lord comes, or he's there in their meditation. Brahma, then he lives with the Purusha, the thousand-headed, thousand-armed Purusha. In other words, the means the universal form is there in the whole universe at the same time as he's in, you know, one place as the associate of Lord Brahma. Like this, and then, you know, he goes through then Shiva's place and finally gets to Vaikuntha. So for those who are following the path of rules and regulations, you know, and that, then generally they go through all this and then finally get to Vaikuntha. But the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, because their only interest is in Krishna, they're not interested in their own. So for them, Varnashram is only for the purpose of cleaning up the material desires that are there. We have to get rid of the material desires, so when they're engaged in Krishna's service according to Krishna's direction, it purifies them and removes them. So that is the only purpose for the Gaudiya Vaishnavas to follow Varnashram, because it clears the heart of unwanted things. Like that means you engage those desires, but that has to be in connection with chanting the holy name. Because our idea is we don't want to go through these different levels in the universe, we're not interested in Vaikuntha. We are only interested in Vrindavan. So therefore then the Gaudiya Vaishnavas generally just pass over that whole thing. They don't bother like that. Though if they want to stop and, you know, check out the heavenly planets for millions of years and waste their time, they can. Krishna will arrange it for them. But generally, no one, the Rajavasis aren't interested, you know. So they just pass over it and go straight to Vrindavan.
Mm-hmm. Can I offer a couple of thoughts? One is they go through it all, but then fast forward.
They just see it and go right by. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's the same thing, but.
Yeah, yeah. You don't stop.
And another thought that I was having some time back, and I would like to present it for your approval or disapproval, to point out the if there's something wrong in the thought. Was that this? If artha and kama are taken without dharma, then it will just be unrestricted sense gratification, and it's the mode of ignorance. So you'll become frustrated, but then you'll go for it again. First marriage, second marriage, third marriage, 8,400,000 species of life just keep revolving. And then in the mode of passion, then you will maybe take the dharma, artha, kama, but you'll become frustrated, and then you'll head for liberation. But in the mode of goodness, your artha and kama is controlled by dharma. And the brahmachari has learned to control his senses in his dharma. So when he goes into the ashram where there is some artha and kama are used, he uses it in Krishna's service, and so it purifies him. It's not that he rejects it in frustration like an impersonalist, and it's not that he just gets frustrated like someone in the mode of ignorance who gets burnt, but then he goes for the next, and then the next, and the next, and the next. But rather, he really purifies himself of that desire or the tendency towards kama and artha, and he goes for real moksha, which is...
Because your ignorance, you don't bother with the dharma, because Prabhupada mentions if people are getting artha, then without the religion, if they don't see the connection, then they don't bother. It's like the parents, they work very hard, very religious, very restrictive and careful and conservative like that. And then with time, then artha starts to come. But their children only see the artha, they didn't see the hard work. So then they may have a tendency to be more, less religious or less theistic. So it's when it's coming, if people think they can get artha without dharma, they'll do it. Most people follow dharma because then they know they will get artha later. So if there's taking dharma and going down in that cycle, then passion would be involved because you're performing the dharma for an activity. Mm-hmm. But if you take the dharma and use it for going up, which means you go from dharma moksha and then to transcend, spiritual relationship, then that would be a lifestyle and goodness. Though following dharma is always considered as goodness, the lifestyle is in goodness, but the consciousness is actually in passion. That's an interesting thing, is you can have someone, you take Charvak, take borrow or steal or get ghee, I think Charvak's, he's connected to the Vaishya Sika, isn't he? I'm not sure if he's not one of the ones. With this lifetime, it's over. So therefore, the best thing is in this lifetime is is ghee, getting something nice to eat. So therefore, one should do whatever one can because when life's over, it's over. And then there's one that goes a little farther, sees a little farther than that. It must be an aspect of Samprayana Purva Mimamsa. And it says that I'm not sure how serious it is, but it's been quoted, is that another birth is easy to get. You'll get one whether you endeavor or not, like that. But to get very nice food when it comes, that's a rare thing. So when you get it, you should eat how much you can. There's some verse like that. So as you can have... The lifestyle may be in goodness, regulated and clean and all that, but the consciousness can be on any of these levels. We see Charvak, it's anamoy. Though, you probably see his lifestyle, he probably lives a dharmic life. So he'll be situated in a sattvic lifestyle, though his consciousness is...
Like a cow. Cow is completely
sattvic. Yeah, that's true. It's a very good example. The cow, the body of the cow is controlled by goodness. You see that you only eat pure things. They like clean places. They like to be bathed every day. They have to be regular. The more regular you can take care of a cow, exactly feed them the same time, the same thing, bathe them at the same time, keep the same environment, keep it very clean, they'll give more milk. Any of those who are disturbed, they give less milk because they're not happy. But that's the body. The gross and subtle body are controlled by goodness. But the soul is in ignorance because they think they're a cow. So the soul is that. But the cow, the gross and subtle body of the cow are controlled by goodness. So that's one thing that maybe many times we get is, may get bewildered by. You know, or you have somebody very sophisticated but very demoniac, or someone very unsophisticated but very, you know, devotional or like this. So these mixes create a problem. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you could say like that. And then the pure goodness is then the understanding, devotion to the Lord. Like that, it would be, you know, unmotivated like that. So that would be, because you have to understand that point, otherwise they will say, well, Dharma automatically means goodness. So how can you say they're in passion? But we see kings who are passionate, though they're following the Dharma. That's their sphere of activities is establishing Dharma. You know, like that. And then you have Brahmins who their area is also goodness, is moksha. But many times their consciousness may also be in a lower level. But in general, that would be a good way.
Because Krishna also speaks about sacrifice in the different modes of nature. Hmm. And so if you're sacrificing in the mode of ignorance, it's not a real sacrifice.
It's unwilling.
But sacrifice in the mode of goodness means that he's someone who he's ready to make that, he's willing to make that sacrifice, and it's a perpetual thing. It means once he goes up, his moksha is, how does Krishna say, having once come back to me, they never return again to this material world.
I would also say is that you could also basically say is those who are understanding transcendence or Krishna, who are theists, then they would be situated in goodness and beyond. Mm-hmm. And those who don't are actually in ignorance, mm-hmm. even though they may be controlled by the mode of goodness. Mm-hmm. Their consciousness is in ignorance. Mm-hmm. Like that. So you have a lot of mixes. That's why the whole thing, the whole Vedic literature, is in one sense confusing. Because there's nothing contradictory, it just depends upon how you're looking at it and for what purpose. The same thing can be categorized in goodness or in ignorance. You know, you would naturally, if you're looking at things socially, the jnani is definitely higher than the karmi. Because the jnani must be renounced. You know, generally a proper jnani must be a sannyasi. Like that. That was Shankaracharya's, you know, one of his points. If someone wanted to come and argue with him, he'd say, first take sannyas, then we'll talk. Because otherwise, as a grihastha, what do you know about impersonal realization? You know, it's like if it's all one and you see it as all Brahman, then what's the need of marriage? You wouldn't be connected with anything, you know. So if my family, the wife, my duties, then that's, you're not seeing it as Brahman, so therefore we can't talk. So you first take sannyas, then we can seriously talk. So in that way, then it's in higher position. They have more knowledge, their knowledge is greater, they understand the workings of the material nature, they understand liberation is a higher position than fruit of activities. But at the same time, is they're still in ignorance, because then they think that they become the Lord. So then it's a problem. You know, while the karmi, he understands he has to please higher personalities to you know, get what he wants. So it's easier to then take out the demigods and put in God than it is for the impersonalists, you know, because they've already taken out God. You know, so to stick him back in is a little more difficult. So that's why you get these seeming contradictions. that one time is explained one way in one scripture, another another. They're talking the same thing, just a different angle, different purpose, different audience. Like that. Sometimes the same thing, just different words. Mm-hmm. You know, like that.
Aren't you generally controlled by that mode in which your consciousness is?
Means where the consciousness goes, and that's generally the mode that is prominent, like that. But at the same time, is there's finer points there. Means it's just like the dharmic person also has to take care of the senses. But because they're taking care of it according to dharma, then it's not considered ignorance. Right? Means the child's in anamoy, but he's in ignorance. He's not following in religion. All he's doing is just anything that comes along puts it in his mouth. But, you know, the qualified Brahman, he also must put something in his mouth. So therefore, according to the, you know, religious system, then he controls his senses, he prepares food, you know, stuff according to certain standards. You know, he eats it according to certain standards. So therefore, he's situated in goodness, though he's engaging the senses, and senses are made out of the material energy, you know, the gross matter. But it doesn't make him in ignorance, like that. So that one has to see what's there. Modes of nature just run everything here. Anything is being created or is developing, that's passion. Anything is being maintained, it's goodness. And anything is being destroyed, it's ignorance. Like you want to sharpen your pencil, right? So you put it into the pencil sharpener and you turn it. So you're creating a sharp pencil, so that's passion. But you're destroying part of the pencil to do that. That's ignorance. So both modes are working there. You know, and then when you keep it nicely and, you know, don't let it roll off on the floor, you're conscious of that so it doesn't break the lead, that's goodness. So for anything you do, it's both, they're all going on. You cook, you're breaking down the cellulose in the vegetables or in the grains or whatever it is. So that's destruction, that's ignorance. At the same time, you're creating a preparation, that's passion. Right? And the reason you're doing it is to maintain the body, so that's goodness. So what we see is that everything's mixed. There's nothing pure in this world. That's why we talk about the three modes and we talk about pure goodness. Because there is no creation, there is no destruction, there's only maintenance. So that's the spiritual world. And the material world is to create something must be destroyed. Right? You want to, like, create a piece of furniture, you must destroy the form of the tree. Right? And then, you know, like that. Or you have planks of wood. You've taken the tree, you've cut it up into pieces. Now you have these nice planks. You must destroy that form to create a table. You know? So that's why ignorance and passion, we can see those are the main things that work in this world. Mode of goodness is very little limited. You know, there's very little maintenance going on. You know, if we check, it's really that the cells in the body are falling apart and new ones are being created. So it's just passion and ignorance. You know, there's a touch of goodness there. They stay for some time. Like that. So we see that's why this world is such a problem, is that it's a fight to maintain goodness. It's easy, passion and ignorance. Those are very easy. Goodness is more difficult. And then pure goodness is then, you know, something else. Does that make sense?
Okay. Give an example of the Muni Charvak Muni. So in which you said that although he's situated in the world of goodness, but his bad consciousness is...
Means his lifestyle, if you check, would be goodness. He would be very clean, he'd live a brahminical lifestyle. But his consciousness is... Where it's situated is in anamoy. So that was actually the ignorance. It's just pleasing the senses is the perfection. Same time you could call that passion, because ignorance doesn't even have an idea really what's going on at all. So when there's desire and endeavor to fulfill desire, you call that passion. But, so he's living a lifestyle of goodness, his purpose is passion, But the goal that he's going into is ignorance. The body is an ignorance. So it's all these things are mixed. So depending on what you want to look at, then you can say it's one or the other. Does that make some sense?
I'm just thinking that, you know, also like we explained the other day, that actually because we come from spiritual world, then we have a different type of perception here. So also in spiritual world and there is no difference between the senses, the mind, everything is unified, but in material world then you have a body, then you have a subtle body, then you have ego, like that. So maybe the body may be situated in one mode, and the subtle body is situated in another mode, and that's where you get that diversity, that there may be activities of the mind and all that, then maybe on the mode of goodness, somebody is living a scientific lifestyle, but the ego and the more subtle elements are controlled by the mode of ignorance.
Yeah, because everything, even the spiritual world, there's activity. There's the transcendental maintenance, or the situation which everything is in. Then there's the activities, and then there's the interaction of that pure love with the Lord. So all those three are always going on there, but they're one thing there. But here, they break into separate. And then they don't necessarily give a nice result. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, it's like in the creation, Vasudeva is the intelligence.
No, Prajumna is
intelligence. Prajumna is the intelligence.
Vasudeva is the consciousness.
Consciousness. Someone was the senses.
Prajumna is the senses, the intelligence and senses. The mind is Aniruddha, and Shankarshan is the ego.
And they were understood to be different modes as well, is it? No.
Well, the mind comes from goodness.
No, that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, the intelligence and the senses comes from passion, the ego comes from out of ignorance.
So his point is that we're always a combination
of those things. Yeah, no, that's true. That's a good point. You understand that? You're just taking it to explain why it's different. That's very good. Yeah, because in the spiritual world, then one's identity is certain of Krishna, one's attraction is to Krishna, you know, one's endeavor and everything is towards Krishna, like that, one's goal is Krishna, so because all of it's the same, therefore it's all, though maybe managed by the different potencies, it's all basically gives one result.
First comment, a question in relation to that. Wouldn't the primary source of bewilderment be the lack of faith in Sampradaya?
He means for all living entities?
And he was talking about how people become bewildered by the Veda. So wouldn't lack of faith in Sampradaya be the root cause of their inability to accept the essence?
Yeah, probably in one sense they won't even know that the sampradaya exists, because in the Dharma Shastra, then you always have paramparas, but they're material. Like gotra is parampara, basically, is that the gotra means is that there's 10 sons of Brahma, so your family line connects back to one of them, you know. So that's quite a an arrangement, that you would have families that know which of Brahma's sons their family is coming down from. It's Gotama or Bharadvaj or which one it was. So that's quite a, you know, it means that there must be some, you know, serious purity and tradition in those families. So that's a parampara. They understand that. There's also the aspect of, you know, the guru and guru's guru and like that, but it's still on the mundane platform. So they, because they have faith in the basically the principle of parampara, but it's at a lower level. Therefore, they're following the Dharma Shastra because they've heard from their parents it's good. They've heard from other, you know, persons that it's good. They've heard from the priests and from the other Brahmins that it's good. They read in the Shastras, so, you know, the Vyasadeva says it's good. So then that aspect is there, but they don't, their parampara doesn't go out of this material world. That's the problem. So it's definitely that you, in one sense, don't have faith, don't know about, like we see Prachina Barhishat, you didn't know about that there was a transcendental, you know, whole lineage of transcendental knowledge. Or someone who does come in contact it, then like what you're saying, doesn't have faith in it because they see it may go against seemingly fruitive activities and fruitive work. You know, like that. So they'll take that. You know, for them, I don't know if we discussed here, for them having a son is so important because then the son will perform the Shraddha rites. Because you have these five debts whenever you're born. You know, so the forefathers, that's the line, your family line. So then you have a debt to them because you're appearing in their family. So because you're in their family, you're getting all the benefits of that. That, you know, it's just like the Pandavas. So then Kuru and Bharat and, you know, all these things. So they're called, you know, the Kauravas or, you know, like this. So that's a prestige that they're from that line. And from that, then they get their respect, they get their facilities. They, you know, so much comes just from that. So for them, that's a very important thing. But we see in devotional service, having a son is not that important. Because we're not, because by worshipping Krishna, then the forefathers are pleased. Right? Because ultimately, if you go back in the forefathers, then you'll get back to those Prajapatis of the Gotra. They'll go back to Brahma, Brahma goes back to Krishna. So if you're worshipping the original forefather, then anyone in between is already pleased. So then, but for some, then that step, for them, they don't have that faith. So you would get that. You know, it's very common. You know, like that. Many who are followers of the Vedas don't have faith in devotional service because to them it may appear irreligious, but they can't understand that it's going to the root of the whole religious process. So therefore, what's in between, if it's important, if it's useful for that worship of the original root, it's accepted. And if it's not useful for that serving the Lord, then it's left aside. But it's not neglected in ignorance, it's neglected in actual transcendental knowledge. You know, we don't worship the forefathers because we're worshiping the ultimate forefather. Where did the forefathers come from? You know? He's the original father. So therefore, we are worshipping the forefathers. You know, we are worshipping the demigods, because the demigods are all just arms of the Virat Purush. And the Virat Purush is just an expansion of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. His energies have simply entered everything. And he's an expansion of Karanadakshaya Vishnu's expansion of Shankarshan. He's an expansion of Balaram, he's an expansion of Krishna. So therefore we are worshipping the demigods, but not in that form, in the original form, is the potencies where they come from, like this. So then in that way it's, let me say, these things are overcome. What was that, I guess?
Yes. How do we understand Shri Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Shri Prabhupada, having so many children, and then all of them are devotees?
I said, traditionally, ladies like children. You know, so therefore, then in running the house, then children are a part of the whole thing. You know, nowadays you don't see big families. We're not accustomed to big families. But before big families, that was normal. You know, someone having, you know, 8, 10 kids was normal before. Like that. That was a normal, like, what do you call it? Not joint family. What's the other one?
Common family.
Common family. There may be 30, 50, 80 people in the family. Like that, the grandfather, then all of his sons, all of their children. like that. So it wasn't an uncommon thing. So at that time, they would be considered very normal. You know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I think, had 10 children. 10 or 12. Something like that. And then, and Prabhupada has what, 3? Mathura Mohan, Vrindavan, and then the daughter. I think it's all 3 children. So that would be considered normal at that time. And then people can relate that their grihasthas are doing what we're doing. They are engaged in devotional service. And so, therefore, we could engage in devotional service. Otherwise, there may come the thing is that, of course, they can engage in devotional service. They're not householders. They don't do what we do. So we're in a different category, so we can't do what they're doing. Therefore, we see that they come and do just exactly what everyone else. Bhaktivinoda Thakur had a regular job like that, had a big family. At the same time as he preached, he wrote books, he did so many things. And he had a nice family. We don't hear of anything breaking up or any of the children being disturbed or anything, you know. You know, just how he would organize his time. So it's, you know, it's like the kids are sleeping at night, so he would take rest early at 8 but get up at midnight, and then he would do his writing and his other things, the sadhana, and, you know, in the morning, and then go to work and then come home in the evening and then, you know, see the this, that, and then. So that way it sets example. That way you have examples for at brahmacharis, grihasthas, vanaprasthas, sannyasis. You have example in all the of all these things. You know, for different purposes. So they're showing how to engage it. Right? And we see like in Vishwanath or Raghunath Das how to be detached from it. Like that. That make any sense?
Yes.
Yeah, because for them it's not sense gratification. It's no big deal. Like that. That's the thing. For us it looks like sense gratification. Because it's our conditioning. But for them, it's not. They're simply, how do you say, fulfilling the needs of the wife. She has that desires to have the children, so this is the process. You know, it would look pretty funny if they just, you know, just chanted a mantra and they just appeared. You know, you wouldn't be able to run a peaceful house. You know, you'd have a huge queue outside your house all day long, people coming to see the kid that manifests out of the Cracker Jacks box or whatever it is. You know, so therefore, you know, just follow the system. You know?
The other thing is that from the point of view of Dharma, like talking manasamita or whatever, Grihastha is obliged to have children. It's a dharmic obligation.
Yeah.
And for Grihastha to not have children is considered irreligious even.
Yeah. It's a natural thing, because when you put man and woman together, if the relationship is nice, they appreciate each other, the natural thing is a child. But it's only in a modern scenario where you have men and women who've grown up not in a regulated life, so they don't know how to live without each other. At the same time, they don't know how to live with each other. At the same time, as they have seen because of this, there's been so much, just frustration. So they can't live without being married, but at the same time, they don't want to fully engage. Get involved in the whole thing, get entangled. Well, the same persons, if they'd been trained nicely, they would just probably naturally not get married. You know, the man had been a good brahmachari, just stay that way. Or the woman, you know, was trained very nicely, she would just stay and not bother. They don't want to get involved, don't get involved. But because of not having that attachment is there, therefore then they need to get married. But at the same time, as they don't want to go any more than that. That's the farthest step. You know, so basically they go from, how you say, you know, bachelor into vanaprastha, like that. But then according to the law, then if they're not, since sex is only had to create children, that means if they're not going to have any children, there's no sex. Like that. So whether they understand or agree to follow that, then, you know, so if they're having sex but not having children, then that's unlawful, that's sinful. Like that. You know, even animals do better than that. At least they have sex, they have children. So if humans don't, then that means then they're worse than the animals. So so it's like you have to take one side, you can't kind of just take what you want, a little bit from here, a little bit from there, a little bit like this. It has to take that one dharma. So it's just they have to see where they're situated. So therefore, since they don't want children, then there's no need of great economic expansion. Just how much it takes to maintain two people. Right? In a sense, yeah, like that. So then it means then the whole material existence is greatly reduced. So then such a couple would naturally would tend to be engaged more in fuller devotional service, because there's no need to get so involved. You know, you do whatever work you do, and that's it. You don't do more. You don't endeavor more. So that means then they can maintain, they can put more emphasis on their spiritual life. So it has to be balanced. But the point is for them it's not sense gratification. Like that. Does that make some sense? Yes? No? How did you?
Oh, you speak
to me. It's your question.
His question.
No, it's your question.
It's my question?
Yeah. It's your question. It's why they're getting, why Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Sri Prabhupada are having so many kids.
There's cases also that there's no children in the last couple of who don't have sex anymore. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. That's there. But then such persons then should not get very much involved. Because if they're not planning to have children and all that, they're not really getting involved in too much. So therefore things like also over-endeavor and ornaments, fancy clothes, nice, you know, bangles, fancy house, great security for the future. All these things that also would naturally not come in the bargain. That's what I was saying, is you don't choose and pick what you want. You know, well, I like this part, you know, but I don't like that part. You know, I like all the gold ornaments, but, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, how you say, please the husband and, you know, create children. You know, it's just, I like them. But then what's the meaning of that? Because they all go, it all connects together. You know, beautiful women create nice children. Not beautiful women don't create children. So since the point is not to create children, therefore then they don't endeavor to expand their beauty. Does that make sense? It's whatever their natural beauty is, they leave it at that. They don't get beyond that. You know? So it all goes together as a complete package. So the point is that they're, as Prahlad was saying, they're performing the duty of a grihastha, so they're doing the duties like that and showing how to do that and be Krishna conscious. You know, like that. It's fine. It means that then we have to see is then, since we feel, you know, not confident in that, then the thing comes is then the duty of the husband is to see that the wife is engaged properly in Krishna consciousness. You know, because other duties are not so important, because the other duties only come up with kids. You only need a house technically because there's children. And because one is engaged in that whole culture, then there's so much other paraphernalia that go with it. Right? means grihastha may be involved in so much of the social kind of things, so therefore they have to dress nicely and they have to, you know, impress others of the same, you know, kind of community. But if that's not the purpose, then one doesn't need so many things. One just needs some, you know, clothes to wear that look proper, and that's it, but nothing impressive. One doesn't have to get the latest cloth this or the latest shirt that, or, you know, it's unnecessary. So therefore, having much possession, having a particular place to stay, it's convenient because then, you know, just have a place, then your life is more regulated. But it's not as important. But when you add children, then you need a place. You need all those things, because then it expands. Like that. So one has to see that. At the same time as then the wife then needs to follow the husband. Means he has she follows the husband and he has to, you know, create an atmosphere in which is a good spiritual, you know, like how you say, sadhana and direction. Like that. So there can't be, means in that there's no independence. Independence means beyond that. Like that. So therefore, you know, husband has his duties, wife has hers. Like that. So it should be, it's actually a emotional dependency, not a physical. Like that. Is that making sense?
I don't quite understand the difference.
Yeah.
Between emotional and physical.
Means
yeah, no, it's true. It means how you say, you understand?
I understand how it could be bewildering to her.
Yeah, yeah. So then the when you're using reasoning, they're disconnected from each other. But in its application, because the mind identifies with the senses, so technically it's, you know, it's the 11th sense. So technically the senses are connected to the intelligence. But because the mind works them also, therefore there's not really a differentiation between the emotions and the senses. In other words, how you say is how you approach it. Means, are the senses used to get emotional happiness, or are the emotions used to get sensual happiness? See, these are the two approaches that are there. Like in a woman, one is called mother, one is called tigress. One is called a religious lady, and one is called, you know, a low-class lady. Depending upon the approach, because the two will be connected. So the point is the emphasis is on why if one is getting married because of the emotional needs, and then along with that, then, you know, you need a place in which to, you know, engage in, how you say, share these exchanges. Right? So that takes care of the physical. It means if you take care of the emotional, the physical is automatically taken care of. If you emotionally care for somebody, the physical is included. Right? But you can physically care for somebody and neglect their emotions. You can see that somebody's fed, clothed, has a place to stay, they're warm in the winter, they're comfortable, but completely neglect their emotions. But the emotions, when you take care of those, automatically include the senses. Right? So therefore, the Vedic culture just focuses on the emotional, and the other comes automatically. So that's what we mean by this.
That's why it's recommended to study somebody's moon.
To study?
To match the moons of the exchange, the two potential spaces.
Yeah, because they should think the same way. Because the moon is the seat of the desires. Unless those are similar, then there's not going to be community there. It has to be some commonality. So it's in the mind. physically they may be the same, intellectually the same, but if emotionally they're not the same, then they won't get along. Right? You don't hear of, you know, how you say, divorce is happening because the other person wasn't great at great mathematician or something like that. You know? So it's like, you know. So, but I say, except of course amongst nuclear physicists, like that. But it's emotional incompatibility. So that's the mind. Emotions means the mind. Mind means emotions. They're synonymous. Okay. Is there anything else on this? Because otherwise, then we should. Okay. So, in other words, this is our description, the Vaishnava description of the Veda. And factually speaking, the Vaishnava description is the description. It's not another description. It is the description because Krishna's created it, and Krishna's expanded everything. That means when Krishna expands, that means there's devotees. Then there's relationship between the Lord and the devotees. Then for those living entities that don't take up the devotional path seriously and develop love for Krishna, they come into this material world. So for them, then the Vedic literatures are given to help them get out of the material world and get situated again back in devotional service. So we see is that there is only the Vaishnava perspective. All other perspectives are incorrect because they're not understanding the purpose, real purpose of the Vedas. So this, what he has just given here is, in a nutshell, the conclusion or the essence or the vision of how the Vedic literatures are seen, how they're broken up. You know, this is another aspect, I think, of what would be meant by tri-yi, you know, this karma yoga, jnana yoga, bhakti yoga.
It is like that.
Tri-yi. Yeah. So Lord Chaitanya gives the real meaning, the real essence of tri-yi, of sambandhavadeva.
What does the term
tri-yi
actually mean?
Tri-yi just means three. Because it's generally, you see, it's you know, but it's, you know, it's just like amongst impersonalists, you say the one, and they all know what it means. So for those in the Vedic, then tri-yi then will mean these. You know, but there's many different finer applications of it. You know. Okay, so we should end here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada
ki jai.